Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. You're listening to CIUT 89.5 FM, www.ciut.fm over the internet. I'm your host, Lauren Corman, here with co-host Jackie Canelli.
Hi.
Today's program, we are going to be speaking with the author Hilary Retegg, who's recently written a book called The Lifelong Activist, How to Change the World Without Losing Your Way. This is put out by Lantern Books. I had actually contacted Lantern Books a while ago before this was even published and had asked them to send me a copy, and they said, well, this actually hasn't gone to press yet, so we're really excited when this book arrived, considering that it deals quite prominently with the issue of burnout, which is something that we keep going back to over and over again on the show as one of the main themes, in particular when we get a chance to talk to somebody who's been involved with animal rights and vegetarianism for, you know, 20 years or 10 years or 15 years or even 5 years. We're always asking how they do it. So in this book, The Lifelong Activist, I'll just read you a little bit about what it says on the back of the book to give you a bit of a teaser for the rest of the interview. So she says here on the back of the book, are you an activist, volunteer, or any other politically active person who is always scrambling for time and maybe leaving some projects undone or poorly done? Do you procrastinate? Are you tired of being broke and always having to scrounge for money? Does instability in your personal life affect your ability to do your work? Does your work interfere with your ability to have a healthy, stable personal life, including good personal relationships? Do you feel like you might be burning out or already have? Or are you the parent, partner, or friend of an activist who worries about these things on the behalf of your loved one? And then she goes on to say that The Lifelong Activist will help, and we'll talk more about all the different ways that this book can potentially help you, as well as offer some critiques that we hope that she will address about halfway through the program as well. I'll tell you a bit more about Hilary once we get her on the line, but we're going to do some announcements, and then I think I'll wait too so Hilary can hear your introduction when she comes on. So I'm going to take a little break and go over to Carl.
Hi, everybody. I apologize if my voice is a little bit raspy today. I have two announcements here. The first is from the Toronto Vegetarian Association. It came to us under the title Getting to the Heart of Healthy Eating, and it begins. A healthy heart is only a workshop away. Vegetarian 101, moving towards a heart healthy diet, presented by registered dietitian J. Beverly Edwards Miller, is a free workshop series that hopes to get Torontonians serious about health. Hosted by the Toronto Vegetarian Association, Vegetarian 101 is not your typical nutrition seminar. Quote, we are thrilled to have a qualified professional like J. Beverly Edwards Miller present these workshops, says Kathleen Farley, executive director of the TVA. Beverly's extensive knowledge of vegetarian diets is matched by her enthusiasm for promoting healthy eating. She excels at translating the confusing science of nutrition into practical guidance on how to make healthy food choices. Edwards Miller is also the Ontario Regional Coordinator for CHIP, the Coronary Health Improvement Project, a 4-week healthy lifestyle education program. Geared towards a non-vegetarian audience, Vegetarian 101 aims to dissect some common health myths of eating a plant-based diet. The 3-part series will focus on the following areas. An introduction to vegan nutrition, the big 3, protein, carbs, and fats, and wrapping it all up, healthy living for a lifetime. The workshops begin Saturday, March 3rd, and continue on March 17th and 31st from 3 to 4 p.m. In room 200 at the Northern District Library. And the second announcement that I have is, I think, also by the Toronto Vegetarian Association and their youth program, VDOT. And it comes to us under the header Food Choices and Environmental Activism. On Sunday, February 25th, 2007, from 3 to 6 p.m. at the Toronto Reference Library, which is at 789 Yonge Street, you can learn about how to become an effective activist for the environment and for earth-friendly food choices. It features a talk from a longtime activist. The talk will be paired with delicious vegan goodies, free snacks, door prizes, and giveaways. You are welcome to bring all of your friends. The event is free and open to high school students and veg and non-veg people alike. And if you want to RSVP, you can email youth@veg.ca, or you can call 416-544-9800.
Great. Thank you, Carl. We'll also make sure that we link to that information on our website, animalvoices.ca. That's where we have all of our archived programs. We have over 180 programs that you can download for free, so check it out. And also, I should let people know that if they have any questions or comments for Animal Voices, do write us at animalvoices, it's all one word, animalvoices@gmail.com. We're going to take a musical break, come back, talk with Hilary Rettig about the lifelong activist, how to change the world without losing your way. My lovely co-host here, Jackie Canelli, will be joining in as well, and we'll hear more about her research and what she brings to the table as well. So please stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren Corman. I should mention that Carl Orzechowski brought us the announcements before, and he is teching for us today. We are speaking about, on this program, the book called A Lifelong Activist, How to Change the World Without Losing Your Way. It's a beautiful title for a book, I think, very compelling. We're speaking with the author, Hilary Rettig. I'm very pleased to have her on the program today. I wrote her a few days ago and said, wow, I really wish I had this book 10 years ago. So I'm excited to find out more about her journey with activism, what brought her to this book, and also if she could help tell us some helpful tips over the course of the interview as well for people who want to start putting some of her ideas into practice right away. We are joined today also by Jackie Canelli, and I will give her the floor for a few minutes before we turn it over to Hilary. So, Jackie, maybe you could tell us a little bit about who you are and the work that you're doing.
Yeah, certainly. Thanks, Lauren. I think I'm coming here today. I think Lauren asked me to be a part of this because of the PhD research that I'm currently engaged in. I'm a student actually at the University of British Columbia in educational studies, and I'm focusing on activism, specifically on young people involved in activist practices across different cities in Canada. Have been talking to them, doing interviews, attending events, things like that. And I also, as an ally to the Animal Voices radio show, I've been a longtime vegetarian and advocate of animal rights, so very sympathetic as well to the issues that are raised in the show. And as Hilary Rettig also notes, that's one of her main focuses these days is on animal issues. So very pleased to be here.
Great. Well, we're glad to have you on the show as well. So I think we have Hilary on the line.
Yes, you do.
Hi, Hilary.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Hello. I'm doing very well. How are you, folks?
I'm good. A very warm welcome to you today. I should mention, too, that you, of course, yes, are involved with the vegetarian and animal movements, which I think, as someone right now for myself and others who are probably listening to the show, it's so refreshing to read a book like this that can reference the animal movements and some of its examples. But, of course, you have a long history of being involved with many different movements, including the feminist movements and the labor movements, too. So I wanted to acknowledge that as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so let's start off. One of the things that Jackie and I were both really curious to hear more about before we jump into an overview of the book and some of the main topics that you address, we wanted to hear a little bit more about your story with activism and the stepping stones that brought you to writing this book.
Well, my own story is fairly circuitous, I think, like a lot of people who are in activist and artistic and other kinds of creative communities. You know, I have worked in high tech for many years. I've been a journalist for many years. I did a lot of activist work in my 20s and 30s. I think it was fairly impassioned work, but I'm not sure that it was necessarily that effective. I don't think my people skills at that time in my life were that effective. And it really wasn't until I hit my 40s that I started to hit my stride. And I actually attended the 2004 Animal Rights Conference. It was down in Washington, D.C., and when I got there, I felt home. Mm. And I felt that, especially I remember going to a workshop on the commonality of oppression, and that took care of all of my concerns all at once because, you know, as people who are in the animal movement know, the real enemy is not necessarily people who eat meat or people who vivisect, but this ethic that says that it's okay to oppress or use or exploit a being, whether it's a human or a non-human being, whom you have somehow classified as inferior to yourself. Mm-hmm. And so that took care of labor, that took care of feminism. I met the most amazing, inspirational people, and I actually went down there to see if some of the skills that I had acquired as a business coach would be useful to activists, and indeed it turned out that they were, and that right there was the genesis of the book.
What was it that brought you to vegetarianism and animal rights in particular?
Well, I had been a vegetarian on and off for maybe 20 years. And when I was at Animal Rights 2004, I saw Peaceable Kingdom, and I became a vegan immediately after that.
Well,
so it was Peaceable Kingdom on a big screen that did it.
Part of what you do in the book is to talk about how activists can market their campaigns better, their message better. And I'm always curious, you know, for someone in a position like yourself, okay, so what got you into it? You know, what worked for you? So it's interesting that that book really resonated and motivated you to change your behavior, which is something that you talk about at the end of the book, about that need for a behavioral change. I wanted to find out more, too, about some of those experiences that you've had working with other activists. I love the story in the book about when you're speaking with an activist and you ask her about, I think it's her sort of her financial goals, and she ends up bursting into tears. And I thought that these stories about working with activists were very enriching. So could you expand more on what your activist experience has been with other activists in that consulting role, and what you do now for other activists?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Yeah, in fact, it's actually, all I asked that poor woman was, how much money do you need to live on?
All right.
And she just totally broke down in tears.
Right.
And because money is a very loaded topic, especially if you've chosen a path that is not going to give you a lot of money in a society that hugely values money.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, no matter how much good you achieve in the world, some part of you might feel like a failure, you know, just because that's the message that you're getting from the greater society. You know, activists have many of the same problems and issues that everyone else has. When I look around me, I see so many people who are just wonderful people, who are doing wonderful things, but they're afflicted by guilt and shame of things they could have done or things they feel they should have done. You know, they're kind of oppressed by societal norms. They're oppressed by their families. Activists are no different, but I think the thing about activists and artists, whom I also work with and coach and am writing a book for, is that, you know, the choices we make amplify a lot of the problems that generally people feel, you know. So, again, you're choosing to basically challenge the status quo. If you're a vegetarian or animal activist, you're actually choosing to fight one of the most profound and established status quo that there is. You're literally telling people what they should and should not put in their mouths or wear on their backs or whatever. I mean, that's a tough, tough, tough challenge. And you're, you know, choosing, in some cases, there are career paths you can take. And then you live with this constant reminder of the world's suffering. And it's pretty profound suffering. What happens to animals, I think everybody listening to this knows, you know, along with us, it's horrible. We live with horrible knowledge, and it's our job never to become inured to that knowledge or psychically numb to it, but we also at the same time have to manage our feelings around it, otherwise we won't be effective. These are tough, tough challenges, and so the message that I have for activists, even more than other people, is that your fears, your doubts, they're totally understandable. It's totally understandable. Just please don't blame yourself or shame yourself or feel guilty, because you know, your responses make total sense in this context.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to say that right off the bat, too, that one of the things that I really appreciated about the book was its sense of hope and just how encouraging you are as an author.
Mm-hmm.
That I really, you know, you talk about being a compassionate observer to yourself. And I think that your sense of compassion for activists and really wanting them to cultivate that within themselves is just a beautiful part of the book. I wanted to go back to working with activists and talk about who are the people then that have been coming to your consulting sessions to do workshops with you, etc. Who are you finding is wanting to talk about these issues, that is actually actively soliciting that advice from you?
Before I answer that question, I want to say something about hope, because it's so important, especially for those, I think, in the vegetarian animal movement, because the oppression is so overwhelming. When I start to get discouraged or other people start to get discouraged, what I do is I go to the website of any major newspaper. I'm a native New Yorker, so I tend to go automatically to the New York Times. And I do a search on the words vegetarian or vegan, and I look at what comes back up. And it is really, really remarkable the concepts of vegetarianism and veganism are rapidly entering the general culture. And it's not just the number of times you have a search on vegan and the number of times it's mentioned, but it's mentioned in all kinds of contexts. You know, you'll read about it in the business section. You'll read about it in the style section. You know, you'll read about it in personalities and weddings. And that really heartens me. I mean, one of the things that oppresses activists is the sense that they haven't accomplished a lot or enough. But, you know, the truth is vegetarian and animal activists have accomplished a huge amount. Because if you look at those citations, and I think if you had done the same exercise 5 or 10 years earlier, you wouldn't see any, and they wouldn't be as respectful. It's not just the number of citations, it's their diversity and the fact that this topic is starting to be treated very, very respectfully, and that is a huge societal change. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to advise people to do that when
okay.
they get
prepped. Thanks for that. So yeah, let's go back to the question about demographics. Who's been soliciting this advice? Who have you worked directly with, and what are some of their experiences?
People tend to come to me when they're in a transitional point and when they're graduating from school, college usually, or when they are stuck and unhappy either with their job or their activism. And when they feel like they're in danger of burning out, sometimes members of activist groups or communities or organizations will pay to have somebody have some of my time, you know, somebody that they value but they feel is just getting burned out. So it's usually people, obviously, you know, when people are in pain or discomfort. Now, the right thing to do is read the book or talk to somebody before that gets extreme. So, you know, the book is designed so that somebody can read it early in their career or at any point, and it empowers them to go forward and, again, be a lifelong activist. You may want to take a sabbatic, and I do advise that people do take sabbatics and move away from activism for 6 months or a year or 2 years if they need to, or however long they need to. But, you know, in the end, you come back, and you're empowered and stronger and more skilled.
Mm. I was interested, too, to find out more about how you developed this methodology, because when I was writing up the press release for this show, and I was saying, you know, this book is more than just a list of do and do nots and tips mm-hmm. for people. It's really a methodology that you're suggesting. And you talked about it at the beginning of the interview coming from a business background. I know that this raises some concerns for activists, wondering mm-hmm. what kind of ideology you're going to be imposing upon them. But I wanted to find out more about this methodology and whether or not you feel that this methodology really could work for a wide diversity of activists, or if it's more targeting somebody who is maybe, you know, middle class or educated in the traditional sort of institutional sense.
Okay,
I guess it's sort of a broad question about that. I think you probably see where I'm going.
Absolutely. Okay. My background, my day jobs in the past and into the present is microenterprise. So I have a business background myself, and I help people, economically disadvantaged people, start small businesses. I have been doing that for years, and I've worked for a couple of nonprofits doing it, and my teams have worked with more than 1,000 people of all types. I've worked with lots of refugees. I've worked with people from inner cities. I've worked with displaced technology workers. I have worked with everybody. And here's what I discovered. The thing that entrepreneurs have in common with artists, whom I've also worked a lot with, and activists, is that they are all what I call ambitious dreamers. They are all creative people who want to make their individual mark on the world, and they haven't lost their dream. Okay. What I discovered helping people start businesses is that there are a lot of people who are smart enough and motivated enough to start a business but never get there. And I looked at that question very deeply, and I looked at the question of what holds professional artists back. And I looked at the question of what causes activists to burn out, and it is basically the skill set that I outline in the book. You know, and this is not something that I've invented. This is ancient, ancient wisdom. And of course, throughout the book, I quote many activists. I quote business and efficiency gurus. I quote Gandhi. I quote Confucius. I quote all kinds of people. It's ancient wisdom. The book begins with Socrates asking, you know, who are you? Who are you supposed to be? And in the book, there are 5 disciplines that I've identified as being key to someone's success, you know, an ambitious dreamer success. You need to know who you are. That means you manage your mission. you need to be able to manage your time so you can reach your goals, the goals that you've uncovered in your mission. You need to manage your fears so that when you come up with your time management, your schedule, you can actually follow the schedule and not procrastinate and not get blocked. You need to manage your relationship with self, which is a way of saying you need to really take yourself and your needs, your personal needs, very seriously and make it a priority, even in a world that's filled with suffering, both because you're a being that deserves respect and care, but also because in doing that, you'll empower yourself to make more, more societal change that you want to make. And then finally, you need to manage your relationship with others. You know, how do you leverage their skills and talents in the service of your goals in a non-exploitive way? How do you convince them to make the behavioral change you want? So there's a logic to it. It is pretty ancient wisdom. It comes from a variety of sources.
I wanted to shift at the, you know, for the second part of our interview into some of those, more of those concerns that people might have about the methodology, concerns around, I know on Vegan Radio you got into a discussion about some of the tactics around, or the language around marketing and sales for your message. So I wanted to jump into that for the second part of the interview, but before we do that, one of the things I really wanted to make sure that we talked about today and put at the center of the interview is, and maybe this is just my own stuff that I'm bringing to it, but around fear and procrastination. I think that's a big and very fruitful section of the book. But it seems like this is something that really does hinder people and that they struggle with, and you have such a positive reading of procrastination as well as a lot of really good ideas about how to get people unstuck.
Yeah, well, when somebody comes to me and says that they're procrastinating, which they usually say with a deep sense of shame, the first thing I do is congratulate them. Because if you're procrastinating, first of all, procrastination is an affliction of ambitious dreamers, ambitious people. And the proof of that is if you Google the word procrastination, you find out about information about how not to procrastinate writing your thesis, how not to procrastinate getting a new job, how not to procrastinate on your exercise regime, how not to procrastinate on your novel, blah, blah, blah. Procrastination is an affliction of ambitious people. And also, if you're procrastinating, it means you haven't given up. There's just a vast number of people who have given up on their dreams, and it's a really sad, tragic thing. The procrastinators, as frustrated as they may be, haven't given up, and that's a big thing in their favor. So first thing I do is congratulate someone. Then I point out that the problem with procrastination is probably not what they think it is. A lot of people think they procrastinate because they're lazy or they're undisciplined or they're immature. Activists add this kind of moral condemnation to it and say, I'm not committed enough to the cause. That is not why people procrastinate. And in fact, many people who procrastinate in one area of their life, and they tend to be dynamos in others. So they're not lazy people, and they're not uncommitted, they're not unfocused, da-da-da-da-da. The reason most people procrastinate, in my experience, is because there's fear. You know, there's fear of failure, fear of success, fear of change. And these are reasonable fears. But if you tackle procrastination as if it's a laziness or discipline problem, you're actually trying to solve the wrong problem, and it's not going to help. And if you tackle it by basically condemning yourself and shaming yourself and blaming yourself, not only is that not going to help, it's probably going to undermine you and make the problem worse. But if you look at procrastination as a symptom of fear that manifests itself through specific behaviors like perfectionism, negativity, hypersensitivity, panic, and you start dealing with those behaviors and dealing with your fears, in my experience, a lot of people, when they start attacking it at that level, they shoot ahead like arrows, even after years or decades, and start making progress.
I think there's a sense, too, for people who procrastinate or chronic procrastinators, you sort of end up being tied down to the procrastination. You know, you think about maybe, you know, checking your email or doing whatever thing, taking a quote-unquote important phone call, and you feel like that you're kind of tied down by it. So instead of it being a real escape where it actually rejuvenates you, it's sort of a trap.
It's a habit. It's a habit, but just like it was learned, it can be unlearned. And the three habits that you need to learn, the habits of productive work, are the following. And again, let's keep in mind that most of us were never taught these. First, you have to be able to sit down and do what you're supposed to do at the exact moment. You're supposed to sit down for work at the exact moment you say you are. 9 a.m., time to start working on your homework or some activist campaign, supposed to sit down at 9 a.m. You're supposed to do exactly what you're supposed to be doing and nothing else. And that means no web surfing, no coffee sipping, no headline reading, not even any other work that seems important. You should be able to really schedule your work and do what you're supposed to be doing. And then the third habit of productive work is to be able to do what you're supposed to be doing for an appropriately long period of time, you know, which could, you know, meaning you should, can you sit down and work steadily for half an hour without a break, or 2 hours without a break, or 3 hours without a break? Most people max out at 3 or 4 hours. So those are the three habits. Most people were never taught them. Some people I work with, when I tell them to practice those habits, that's actually enough. But most people can't succeed at those habits until they actually deal with the fear that is causing their procrastination.
I wanted to know if you procrastinated at all with this book. Does it still haunt you?
Yeah, for now. No. You see, that's the thing. You never, you know. Okay, two things. First of all, I did procrastinate with the book. However, you're talking to somebody who had, at one point, a 20-year writer's block. So procrastinating is no big deal. All right? I still procrastinate. But as I told the members of the Boston Vegetarian Society last night, nowadays I procrastinate on a higher class of problem. Mm. Okay? I don't know anyone who doesn't procrastinate. I think there are probably a few people, but I think everybody does it to some degree. And I know really successful business people and academics and activists. And I think pretty much everybody, mm-hmm. with minor exceptions, procrastinates. The question is, how long do you do it? How badly do you do it? On what do you procrastinate? You can procrastinate on the first chapter of your book, or in going to an activist meeting and showing up, or you can procrastinate on marketing and selling your book, you know, which is a more complex task. I'm happy I'm procrastinating on the second, the more challenging one.
Right. Would you say
in
this?
Yeah, go ahead.
I was gonna say maybe this is too personal of a question. You don't have to answer it, but I wanted to ask if that is related to a particular fear or fears that you have.
I'm from
about
New
the
York.
Book.
You can ask me anything.
Okay, I wanted to ask if that is related to a personal fear that you have, or fears that you have about the book or about marketing or any of that.
Yeah, I have the same fears as everyone else, and I have, you know, I mean, I have, you know, fears that my projects are going to fail, or I have fear that they're going to succeed and things are going to get complicated. I don't experience them that much. I don't procrastinate nearly as much as I used to.
Mm.
You know, and the thing to do, and I think you mentioned earlier, what do I do when I procrastinate? The thing I do not do is sit there and say, oh, Hillary, you're terrible, you're dreadful, you're a loser, you wrote a book, you should do better, da, 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 da. I don't do that. I just say, okay, why am I procrastinating now? What is going on? And I journal about it, and this is what I advise in the book. I journal. I do not call myself names because that's counterproductive and it's uncompassionate, and it's also inaccurate because I'm not a lazy person, et cetera. And I just journal about what's going on in my life now. Now, you can procrastinate for a lot of reasons. Most of the reasons people procrastinate are actually quite reasonable reasons. So maybe you're procrastinating because the project is not clearly drawn, so you don't actually know what to do. The solution is not to call yourself lazy, but go back and get the information you need. Maybe you're procrastinating because you don't think the project will succeed. Okay, that doesn't mean you're undisciplined. That means you should go back and see if you can work with someone to reformulate it for better success or redefine what you consider success. Maybe you're procrastinating because you had a fight with your parents or your kids or someone over that morning and you're all ruffled up about that. Well, one solution may be not to call your parents until after you've gotten your day's work done. I mean, but these are all, you know, reasonable things.
Hillary, we're going to take a short break, musical mm-hmm. break. We'll come back. We'll play some ads, too. We'll come back, and I'm going to turn over at least part of the conversation to Jackie, and we'll continue talking about the lifelong activist, how to change the world without losing your way. Please stay tuned. Hello, and welcome back to Animal Voices on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm your host, Lauren, here with Jackie, co-hosting with me today. We're speaking with the author, Hillary Rettig, about her new book, The Lifelong Activist, How to Change the World Without Losing Your Way. Before the break, we were talking about some of the key key points of the book, as well as finding out more about Hillary's journey with activism as well. And I wanted to, as we're turning now into the second part of the interview, I wanted to relate a little bit of a story, and I'm hoping that people will understand what I'm talking about, which is a while ago, right when I first got involved with animal activism, I remember being at a circus protest, and I was out there with a big line of people and holding a sign that had, you know, pictures of elephants being chained, etc. And I remember people walking by, and, you know, this is people being really angry at us for protesting the circus, and saying, "Get a job! You should go get a job!" And there's a sort of this accusation that if you're an activist, that you don't have a job, or I think that probably what Hillary would suggest for us is careers. And I guess that moves into this sort of broader conversation I wanted to have, because one of the main themes that I was finding in the book was this emphasis on employment, sustainable employment, getting a good paying career that will support you as you continue with your activism. And in the book, Hillary talks a lot about how it can be very draining, to be poor. So, with that in mind, I wanted to turn it over to Jackie, who had some questions about thinking about jobs and careers, and what are some of the structural barriers that people might face. So,
yeah,
over
thanks,
to you,
Lauren.
Jackie. So, Hillary, I hope you're still on the line.
I certainly am.
Okay, great.
Hi, Hillary.
Hi.
Lauren and I are playing a little bit of good cop, bad cop, where she gets to set it up, and then I'm going to be asking some of the slightly tougher questions, or some of the questions that I think are important to talk about in your book, which is a really interesting book and I think really helpful for a lot of people.
That's unfair of me then. I'll have to make sure that I do the bad
cop. I'm the guest host. That's you know, I don't have the long history with the show, so I'm happy to do it. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about some of the, well, I'm actually going to start in a different direction than Lauren's great setup. I'm sorry, Lauren.
That's okay.
But one of the things that I was wondering about, and this is a question that relates to struggles I've had myself in trying to navigate living in this world that is, you know, there's lots of unethical practices that we encounter every day, and consumption practices, and the pressures to take part in society and structures that we might not always agree with. And you start out the book by encouraging people to live what they need to live in order to be happy, and including, you know, buying what you need, taking part in the practices that you need to feel good about yourself. And I was wondering how you reconcile, especially in terms of the animal movements, how often our focuses have been on personal consumption practices and how to eat ethically, you know, how to wear clothes that are ethically created and things like that, in terms of finding that balance between going out and doing what you need to do versus also being conscious of the different practices that might be harming animals or other people and things in the world. So just wondering what kinds of thoughts you have about that tension.
Well, I don't have a definitive answer, because it's really something everyone has to decide for themselves. And I try to be really, really compassionate, because I'm not sure there is any pure way to earn a living in a capitalistic society, or certainly North American capitalist society, without hurting animals or hurting other humans. That's just the reality of the ecosystem, the economic ecosystem we live in. I have some of my really close friends, and some of the people I advise are Freegans, Freegans, freegan.info is their website.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they basically do a lot of dumpster diving, and try never to use even, you know, any kind of petroleum-based transportation or anything. I mean, compared to those people, my lifestyle's totally compromised. On the other hand, compared to, you know, a typical American lifestyle, particularly for somebody my age, and, you know, I'm almost 50, I actually have a fairly low touch on the environment and on the animals.
Right.
So people have to decide it for themselves, and I work hard not to judge.
Mm-hmm. And so then circling back a little bit to what Lauren was talking about around jobs and the sort of access to careers versus jobs and who can attain those kinds of things, because I think, like as Lauren mentioned, you emphasize in the book the importance of trying to find some kind of sustainable work that will allow you to have a decent living and make a life for yourself that isn't going to be constantly wrought mm-hmm. with grinding poverty. And mm-hmm. Just wondering about the maybe any ways, like people that you've worked with as well, people who come from different backgrounds with different histories and the kinds of thinking about the kinds of structural barriers that still exist in society in terms of equitable access to different jobs and careers and the possibilities of moving into careers and what it means for activism okay. as well in terms of who has access to become an activist even in the okay. first place.
Mm-hmm. Let me reiterate the fact that I have worked with an incredibly diverse groups of people, not just with the activists. I would say that the activists I work with, because I do coaching for money, they do tend to be middle class or somewhere, you know, around the middle class.
Yeah.
In my micro enterprise work, where I actually work with many activists in that too, because they want to start nonprofit organizations, and I work with many artists and of course entrepreneurs. I work with an incredibly diverse group of people. And it's interesting because when you do microenterprise work, the reality is most of the people you help are not in a position to start a business, so you wind up helping them get work.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a well-known statistic that something like 85% of job applications are screwed up. Mm-hmm. The person either has a typo or they've sent it to the wrong person or they didn't follow the directions or they've done something that really immediately disqualifies them. I actually do a lot of work with activists and others in helping people get their resumes in order and helping them get work. And I tend not to focus so much on institutional barriers. And that is one thing that does set me apart from other people on the left. And I am way over on the left. But I find that that is not very productive. That's productive to do in your activism, and I'm grateful to the people who are doing it. But when it's time for you to go out and get a job and support yourself, at least in American culture, U.S. culture, which is what I'm familiar with, it's pretty easy to get past barriers. And a lot of people don't believe that. But right now I'm helping, for instance, a gentleman from the Congo who, you know, and I've been getting him mentors and free websites. I mean, so I'm a nonprofit. I work for a nonprofit that exists to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I do tend in the book and outside the book to really let the institutional barriers exist, but work on ways around them. And I find that in this culture, it's pretty easy to find those.
Mm.
Now, again, let me also point out, most of my work is done with people who live in big cities.
Right.
The dynamic may be different if you're in a small town, economically depressed, limited number of employers. I think that could be a much harder problem.
Right, right.
Yeah, I guess, I mean, it seems to, and maybe we're using these terms interchangeably, but this question around institutional barriers, those sort of more structural kind of things, I think relate to this broader critique that I think, Hillary, you bring to, and certainly Jackie and I do as well, around systemic oppression in society and how that plays out when people attempt to get jobs. You know, mm-hmm. so that people will encounter racism. Of course, you know, I have friends of mine who, with disabilities, very highly educated, but just can't get jobs. You know, perfect uh-huh. resumes, everything else. She comes in for an interview, she gets shot down every time. Uh-huh. So about, you know, questions of ability and that kind of systemic oppression and how that prevents people from moving ahead and doing and being able to have access to this wonderful world in some ways of activism and to be able to have that in their lives by having a good paying job. And she, for example, this friend of mine, just is not able to achieve that right now.
People with disabilities have it, I think, about as rough as anyone has it. And I actually work with the Massachusetts Department of Social Services, which exists to support some of those people. But I would be remiss if I didn't, like, be very clear on what I think. Most of the people that I work with, most of whom do not have disabilities, most of whom are not in, like, really economically underprivileged areas, most of the people I work with have a great deal of control over their economic destinies. They may not be rich. I mean, I'm never going to be rich because there's a vast number of jobs that I just won't do, but I can be comfortable. And I believe that that's true for many, many, many activists, most of the people I meet in the activist world. And that may be a controversial viewpoint, but that's what I see, and it behooves me to be honest and report what I see.
No,
most,
I was going to say, I appreciate that in this book that you talk about telling the truth as you see it, even though it might be controversial. And I really appreciate that. I really also like that you encourage people to be, I think your expression is, relentlessly honest with themselves as well. So, you know, as we're bringing up these questions, it's very much in the spirit of appreciating you putting out there for us to engage with these controversial views. I think they're really important. I know Jackie had another question.
Well, let me also just say that I'm not saying that anybody should live a certain way. In fact, I say in the book several times that I'm not saying that. I'm saying you should figure out what you need to be happy and then go after it, not live a deprivational lifestyle, because that's just not a sustainable strategy. I mean, if someone's happy being a freegan and living in a squat and, you know, making $1,000 a year and living on that, I have absolutely no problem with that if they're happy and they're meeting their responsibilities. On the other hand, if somebody needs $100,000 and a sports car, I'm not going to judge that decision. I mean, my choices are not pure either. Mm. So, you know, this is where a lot of activists, and I'll also say artists, a lot of them aren't aware of their skill sets. They don't actually, in my experience, a lot of them don't know what else they can do. They need to take a break. They're burned out, and they don't know what else to do. And so they're kind of on this really kind of torturous, long march. They're still doing activism. They're still going to their art studios every day. They're not really productive. They're burning out, and they don't see the door to another life or to a sabbatical. I try to offer them the door, because the reality is a lot of activists have skills that are broadly transferable. You know, it gets tricky. The more vegan you are, the trickier you get. And there are vegans out there who would not like some of my choices. But, you know, you can work in a helping profession. You can work for a nonprofit or a charitable organization. You can get a job directly helping animals. People do that. So the trap you want to avoid is feeling like you have no choices.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, I mean, this is one of the things that I feel like in my own research and my own thinking about activism, that, you know, I'm constantly trying to think about those structural barriers, those systemic oppression, and how it encumbers people. But I'm also, you know, always want to be appreciative of agency and choices, even in the most dire of situations. You know, we're talking about, I think, very much in this conversation, focusing on a North American context and activists in North America. But, of course, there are people all over the world and in North America as well in very dire situations that continue to do activism in the middle of all that, right? And so people do always have some kind of agency and are able to make some kind of choices, although there are those sort of, of course, larger structural issues that need to be reconciled with. And I think that you point out quite correctly that activists need to be addressing.
So, Hillary, I'm going to bring up another kind of question that was nagging me as I was working through your book.
I hope it's a tough question, Jackie. I'm still waiting for these tough questions.
Okay.
I'll do my best.
I'll do my best.
I know we're all compassionate animal activists, but talk it to me.
So this question I have, let me try and kind of articulate it clearly. It's spinning off of what Lauren was just talking about around the idea of choice and the idea of the kind of focus on our own happiness as individuals. And you talk about self-actualization in the book, about needing self-actualization. That, you know, that's really compelling, and I've definitely taken advantage of that kind of language and thinking in my own life and trying to work through issues and getting unstuck in certain ways. But I also think there's a limit and a danger to the self-actualization language and the kind of thinking about the world and about sort of philosophies of life in terms of becoming happy as an individual and trying to ultimately become sort of a perfect individual, you know, which I think is this kind of lineage. This is a really powerful cultural message right now. And I see it going in two directions. One is it can become so much about the focus on the individual. And this is relating back to my question about the balance between consumption choices versus trying to make yourself happy. So it can lead in the one direction towards just ultimately letting go of all ethical obligations and just focusing on the self and becoming sort of oblivious to the larger issues. You're not advocating that at all, but I'm just talking about this self-actualization trend and where I think it can possibly go. And then on the other hand, I think it can also lead to almost becoming exactly what you're asking people not to do, which is self-berating because I didn't reach my ultimate perfection. And so ultimately coming back and coming back and coming back, so it becomes navel-gazing and then also is crippling in terms of people's activism and being able to engage in the world in a more socially embedded public way. So I don't know if you followed that, but just kind of thinking through those issues around what is the balance between self-actualization versus being part of a community and recognizing we are all imperfect subjects who are, also have a lot of responsibility to the world. Where is that balance and how do you strike that, both in the book and in your own work and teaching with people?
Well, my experience, I don't mention it in the book explicitly, but maybe I should. My experience working with activists is most of them have a deep horror that if they get off the treadmill, they're going to reveal their inner self to be just very selfish and self-centered and uncaring and all of the rest of that stuff. That's part of what keeps them from taking a break and keeps them from actually doing as good work perhaps as they could have. They have a fear of what they're going to be or who they're going to be if they stop. And the truth is, the activists that I work with and the activists I know are wonderful people all the way down. And they need to be compassionate with themselves and with others. And when they do, sometimes they, you know, they need to take a sabbatic. And I wind up doing that a lot. I give people permission to stop doing activism for a little while. Mm-hmm. Now, some of those people may stop doing activism forever, but I don't know that anybody has, and I think the odds are against it. I think most of the activists I deal with are good people who care about the world, and it may be that their activism takes another form. I mean, they could, you know, retire to the suburbs and raise two kids or one kid, and, you know, and maybe their activism in the future is going to be just writing a check. Well, you know, activist organizations need checks, too. I mean, so there's a big activist ecosystem out there, and there's lots of niches for all of us. But the reason I focus the way I do is because so many activists are so far from this problem where they're going to go overboard and turn into, you know, egocentric, selfish monsters.
Right,
there's like a real deficit there that I'm trying to correct.
Counterbalance.
Yeah, that they basically feel like that they're horrible, they're not accomplishing enough, they're not giving up enough, they're not focused enough. And they feel that way because they have ordinary human needs and constraints and fears. Mm-hmm. So that's my role, is to help them feel good about themselves as imperfect, complex, beautiful human beings and activists.
This is making me think, too, about just doing activism within the context of capitalism. And I think that what capitalism does is it preys upon those insecurities, it exploits them, and the way that a lot of advertising works is to say that you are not adequate as you are, and so you need to buy this thing, which is something that you point to in the book as well, sort of like that trap. And so it seems like it's really, I mean, you're surrounded by this stuff all the time, and I remember a friend of mine saying it's a very revolutionary perspective to think that you're not a piece of crap in this society. And that is a really sad fact. You know, you have people who are trying to do really compassionate, beautiful things, thinking constantly that, and this isn't true right across the board, but for a lot of people, thinking that they're not enough. And it's such a sad thing. And I mean, this is, of course, why books like The Lifelong Activist, I think, are so important, because they can help encourage people to shift from that perspective.
Well, you know, and it's interesting because the woman who yelled at Lauren saying, get a job, I mean, she doesn't know whether Lauren has a job or not. You know, this woman took 3 hours, you know, to go to the demo. This woman took 3 hours to go to the circus. You know, you could both be employed or unemployed. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, what she was saying was be normal, quote unquote, according to her definition of normal. And the reason she felt compelled to say that, I think, was on some level Lauren's presence made her uncomfortable, and in exactly the way that you're describing. You know, we're a threat just by our benign choices about how we live our own lives. We are a threat to the status quo. Now, what I would tell activists is be joyful. Love who you are. I love activists. You know, all of us have implicitly made a decision to be progressive, and many of us have made a decision to be activists. Now, we've made these decisions because we feel on some level that's the better way to live, not just ethically, but I think just better emotionally. We're happier because there are ethical people on the other side as well. We have made a decision to be progressives and activists because on some sense it makes us happy. And I think the reason it makes us happy is because progressivism is really cool. It's really liberating. It's really, you meet the most wonderful people. It's doubly true if you're an activist. It's a wonderful, wonderful, lovely way to live in kindness and compassion. And you know what? If more progressives and animal activists felt their joy, enabled them to see what their achievement is, it's a huge achievement to live your own values in this kind of society. And also to see we're winning. We are winning. And I go back not only to the, you know, the example I gave earlier with the New York Times, you know, you do a search on veganism and you can see how rapidly it's entering the culture. But, you know, society is getting more liberal. And, you know, when I was growing up, and again, we're only talking 45 years ago, you were a bad parent if you didn't give your kid meat every night. Now you're a bad parent if you do. Hmm. I mean, that's a profound, profound change. If I could say one thing to the people listening to this show, it would be, first of all, be very kind and compassionate about who you are, because you're a really special, valuable person. And let your joy show, because that will make it easier for everyone else, all the other activists, some of whom may be struggling to greater or lesser degrees. Let's all strive to be, to access the joy of being a progressive activist and help others access it too.
Hillary, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. I wanted to let people to know as well that this doesn't have to be the end of the conversation about this book or with you. You do have your own website called The Lifelong Activist. I think it's lifelongactivist.com. Is that
correct?
The website?
Yes.
So people can go and dialogue with you on the site. You do a blog as well. And then there is Vegan Radio that did an interview with you. I think that you're going to be doing more interviews to come as well that will be people will be able to access online. And, of course, Lantern Books. You can buy the book from them, or it's available through, you know, various different websites as well. Very, very easy to find this book. Thanks so much for being on the program.
Thanks, well, thank you for having me, Lauren and Jackie. It was a pleasure.
It was our pleasure, too.
Definite pleasure.
Great.
thanks so much. We were speaking with Hillary Rettig today about her book, The Lifelong Activist, How to Change the World Without Losing Your Way. Very interesting read. And I just want to say thanks to Carl for teching, and please stay tuned for Roadrunner. And, of course, Jackie, thank you for being here.
Thank
it
you,
makes
Lauren.
Me sad that you're not going to be in Toronto much longer, because I'd love to have you back on. You've been listening to Animal Voices, CIUT 89.5.